From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. North Carolina agriculture is facing a host of challenges. The Trump administration has levied tariffs against many countries, more notably China, Mexico, the European Union, Canada. According to White House officials, the tariffs will force trading partners into adopting fairer practices. But farmers, manufacturers, and beyond in the U.S. are grappling with retaliatory tariffs. China alone has slapped tariffs on hundreds of U.S. goods. Economists say this will decrease agricultural exports, a key component of North Carolina's economy. State agriculture is also bracing for impacts from nuisance lawsuits over hog farming practices. Juries decided three recent cases in favor of plaintiffs, handing the world's largest pork producer, Smithfield Foods, penalties in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. Both Pender and Brunswick counties have adopted resolutions to support local farmers and the North Carolina Farming Act of 2018. Congressman David Rauser, a Republican from North Carolina's 7th District, which includes the Cape Fear region, recently held a farming roundtable discussion to denounce the lawsuits, and he, along with U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, also a Republican from North Carolina, has suggested federal legislation to combat such suits. With us to explore the impact of all these factors and the rain, Thomas Grennis, Professor Emeritus of Economics and Agricultural Resource Economics at NC State University, and he joins us today via Skype. Thomas Grennis, welcome to Coastline.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
Mark Blevins is the director of the Brunswick and New Hanover County Cooperative Extension for NC State. Mark Blevins, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rachel.
And Mark Seitz is director of the Cooperative Extension for Pender County. Welcome, Mark Seitz.
Thank you, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Are you a farmer in the Cape Fear region? What challenges are you facing? Are the tariffs impacting you? Or are you concerned about the precedent set by these nuisance lawsuits? You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Professor Grennis, as you've observed, the situation with the international trade war changes on an almost daily basis. As of Wednesday, August 8th, 2018, can you tell us where we are now?
Yes, it certainly is changing. So the United States is currently involved in a kind of trade war that started back in March, when the United States imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum. After that, the process escalated, and more countries got involved, more products, higher tariff rates, and now we're beginning our sixth month of this kind of tariff war. In addition to the U.S. actions, every country that was subject to the tariffs retaliated against the U.S. and retaliated in various ways, but it's usually been tariffs against U.S. exports, and they've especially chosen U.S. agricultural exports. So that's important for our discussion today. So I can say in general, there's been, over these last 6 months, an escalation, consistent escalation of the tariff process. It's still going on, and even as of yesterday, the United States announced some new tariffs against China that will go into effect later in August. And the same day yesterday, China announced they will also impose new tariffs against the U.S. the same day. And I guess the last point here would be that this whole process should be especially important for North Carolina agriculture, and especially the eastern part of the state, which is a main exporter of agricultural products, including what, of course, pork and poultry and tobacco and soybeans and other products.
Mark Blevins and Mark Seitz, a lot of people don't think of the farming part of North Carolina as being in Pender, Brunswick, and New Hanover County, but there are plenty of farmers around there. Mark Seitz, can you tell us who works as a farmer in New Hanover County? In Pender County, what kind of products come out of that county?
Our main row crop production is corn and soybeans. Farmers in the county grow about 13 to 15,000 acres of each of those products every year. It varies on crop rotation purposes and what land they are renting in a given year. There's a little bit of cotton grown, a small amount of tobacco still grown in the county, but mostly it's corn and soybeans. And we also do 2,000 acres of blueberries in the county.
And Mark Blevins?
That's right. grains are our biggest part of agriculture. It's a 40,
and you're talking about Brunswick County specifically.
Brunswick County, that's right. And in that county specifically, it's a $45 million industry, agriculture is. And that doesn't even include all the forestry that happens back in the swampland. So grain's the biggest thing, but we do have a dozen pork producers, one of which got into the North Carolina Hall of Fame for pork production this year. So really happy about the ARPS in Winnebago.
And what about New Hanover County? Are there farmers there? And understanding, too, you're interim director of New Hanover County right now. And
yes.
When is there going to be a permanent?
Proud to serve. And there should be somebody new coming up at the Arboretum, hopefully next month. So stop by and see those new faces there as you stop by the plant clinic with your garden and vegetable problems. Because it's tough to be a farmer. And you can grow your own food right down here. So give it a shot and see what these farmers are up against. So, yes, in New Hanover County, though, the Tinga Nursery and other nurseries are the biggest agricultural production. But remember, we're on the coast, and so we have fishermen, too. So lots of great folks that are working hard to bring us food from the waters as well.
How are these retaliatory tariffs impacting North Carolina products? We've heard a lot about pork. Now, Smithfield, the world's largest pork producer, as I understand it, is actually based in Hong Kong, not headquartered in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I don't know, it was three or four years ago, Smithfield Corporation got bought out by a Chinese business owner. the pork is still produced here. Smithfield has processing plants in Bladen County, in Tar Heel, and I don't remember where the other ones are. But essentially, the production in Pender County, all of the grain production in Pender County, or the vast majority of it, is sold to the pork and poultry industry to feed the animals. And then the export that we do is the protein product, the chicken and the pork. And our grain producers, like I said, 13 to 15,000 acres. It generates about $35 million in revenue. We have more pork producers in Pender County than Mark does in Blender County. Yes.
Blender and Blender.
He's got
it's
two.
A big mix.
He's got two counties down there. I can't keep up with them. But down in Brunswick County and our turkey production in Pender County is probably our bigger our bigger industry than pork, but we do have a large pork industry. Combined, they do about $120 million in sales annually.
Professor Grenes, help us understand how the products, the agricultural products that are not exported, but those that are sold domestically, how are those impacted by these international tariffs? What does that do to the price of them here?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the same products. You mean soybeans that are exported and soybeans that are sold here.
Right.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, it's the trade that connects them. The fact that they are internationally traded so that if they got out of line, if foreign prices of soybeans were much higher than domestic prices, they would all get exported. And so it's a profit motive that tends to keep the prices together. So one of them goes up, the other one tends to go up also. Now, of course, if there's some transportation costs or some kind of barriers to trade, then that'll tend to separate them. And we're seeing some of that in soybeans now, I think.
And Mark Blevins or Mark Sykes, can you talk about what farmers are grappling, how you're seeing these tariffs impact farmers today? We hear a lot of talk about it. Is there a delayed reaction, or are they already kind of reeling from this? Mark Blevins.
So 10 years ago today was the start of the Olympics in China. So it's interesting that we're talking about this today. The demand for soybeans and pork products in China has been growing over the last decade and several years. So the United States and Brazil are the biggest suppliers for that soybean supply chain in China. And so our producers locally realize that our production is tied to a much larger global picture. And the farmers I've talked to over the last couple of weeks have been concerned about that. What's that going to do to prices? Because the vast majority, 97% of the farms in the United States are family-owned farms. So these tariffs, these trade wars, these commodity prices affect local families just as much as any other part of the country. So they're concerned, and yet every farmer that we always talk to, everybody, hope rings eternal. So they're always optimistic, and yet the tariffs are, and international situation is putting a little bit of concern into that mix.
We had an email. Chad Herring writes, I live in Eastern North Carolina. I'm a contract grower of pigs for Smithfield Foods and serve as executive director of NC Farm Families. Right now, the nuisance lawsuits are the biggest blip on my radar. However, he writes, farmers are also taking a hit with 25% tariffs on the pork they grow and now soybeans they raise. Is there another way, he asks, to address unfair trade practices and at the same time lift this additional burden off farmers? Professor Grennis.
Yes, there is another way, but until now, the administration in Washington has chosen not to use this way. So the United States is a member of a number of organizations, World Trade Organization being one, and virtually all the countries in the world are members, including China, North American Free Trade Agreement's another one. So it's not unusual in business to have disputes, business disputes, and what is needed is some dispute settlement process.
And in the Professor Grennis, sorry to interrupt. I'm going to ask you to continue your answer to that question when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're looking at the escalating U.S. trade war through the lens of North Carolina agriculture, a key sector of the state's economy. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. Tell us what you think by calling us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're taking a look at North Carolina agriculture in light of international tariffs, seemingly relentless rain this summer, and some of those nuisance lawsuits filed against Smithfield, the world's largest pork producer. With us today, two directors from the NC State County Cooperative Extension offices. Mark Blevins heads Brunswick and New Hanover counties, and Mark Seitz leads the Pender County office. Thomas Grennis is professor emeritus of economics and agricultural resource economics at NC State. He's joining us via Skype on this Wednesday. And we want to hear from you. Do you think North Carolina farmers are under attack? Do you think a whole paradigm shift needs to happen for North Carolina farming families? Give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Professor Grennis, just before we went to break, you were explaining some of the other options for addressing unfair trade practices instead Yes. of engaging in a trade war.
Yeah, so the question is there another way to resolve these disputes? And there is, and it's to go through the World Trade Organization or the NAFTA dispute settlement process. So the United States, all of its major partners are members. And so you could go through this process. And in particular, on this question of stealing technology by China, many other countries also think China is violating rules, and so those same rules. And so it would be possible for the United States to have an alliance, to go together with their EU partners, with the NAFTA partners, all of them together, go to the WTO and make this formal complaint. Now, some people ask, is the WTO also cheating the United States, or are they fair? And you look at the cases the United States have taken to the WTO, and they've won 90% of the cases. So if they have a good case, WTO has been favorable for them. One other point about soybeans, which is a target for China, I would just want to say that China is a very important market now for North Carolina soybeans. And once you establish a market, it's difficult to establish a market. It's easy to lose it. Go back in history, 1973, the United States imposed an embargo on soybeans going to Japan. and that had long-term effects. It had been very hard for Americans to regain that market. And way back in 73, Brazil started expanding their soybean production, and they're still a major competitor. So it's easy, it's hard to establish one of those markets, but it's easy to lose it.
So is it true that soybean prices have dropped to a 10-year low?
They're extremely low. I don't think the tariff is the entire reason, but that's the only part of it.
Let's take a look for a moment at these recent so-called nuisance lawsuits filed by neighbors of hog farms in North Carolina. They've complained about the smell, the flies, the rumbling trucks at all hours of the day and night. A jury decided in one of these suits that Smithfield Foods should pay $473.5 million to 16 neighbors of three industrial-scale hog farms. That jury award is, of course, massively cut by a state statute that limits such awards. But help us understand first, Mark Seitz, how a family farm is considered industrial scale in a lawsuit. I think there's some cognitive dissonance for people who aren't in the business. We think of Smithfield Foods as this huge international conglomerate, and then you've got a family farmer. What are we talking about?
Well, I think over the last however many decades, our food industry has evolved from, you know, say 100 years ago, people, 75, 80, 90% of the country's population was directly involved in food production. And so, you know, you raised your family cow and you raised a beef cow and you raised some chickens and you raised your own pigs and you did your own processing at home. As our economy got bigger and people had found more opportunities off the farm, that demanded more economies of scale where where the food industry needed to ramp up and to be able to feed the population. So fast forward to today, the way these corporations work is they sign a contract with a family farm to be the producer of the raw product. And then that takes the marketing and the processing burden off of the family to move those animals or to move that grain. So it's just a straight contractual relationship.
So then how would tariffs impact these family operations if they have a contract with Smithfield Foods?
Well, in the short run, it certainly will slow down the sale or the, I should say, it'll back up the quantity in storage, like in a pork or poultry processing system. That meat is getting frozen at the processing plant.
And so who owns it at this point?
At that point, it would be the processor. It would be Smithfield or Prestige Farms or whoever the processor is, owns the product. And so as they get backed up, there's going to be less demand for new animals to be produced on the family farms. And so there's just less sale or less movement of animals going through these farms. And so the farmers just don't make as much money.
And so these contracts then last for a certain term. Are
Yes.
they annual things or seasonal agreements?
They're, depending on the commodity, they're annual generally. I think the pork and poultry producers will sign like a 2-year rotation contract. I've never seen those contracts in writing myself, but it's that kind of a relationship where they will go on a schedule so that, you know, these family farmers have to invest hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars for the facilities to produce them the way the processor wants. But they, you know, so the farmers have got to make, they've got to put animals through those facilities to be able to get paid. And if they normally get three rotations of pigs through a barn a year, these tariffs might slow that down to two. And so it has an impact economically. It'll slow the production down.
That risk keeps getting back to the farmer that's just down the road from you. So this big system, this big international system, the changes there affect your neighbor. So all that stuff, the risk of the contract, the risk of the prices, the risk of the weather, that's local. So that's the effect that it has here.
So Smithfield requires a process, and they own the animals. Is yes. that correct?
Yes.
And so they're hiring the farmers to take the animals through a process and deliver them a certain way.
Yes.
And you said, just Mark, I want to make sure I understand this, that part of this agreement is so that some of the risk is taken off the little guy, the family farmer, and that risk then is held by this multinational corporation.
Yes.
But it sounds like that's not really the case. It sounds like the family farmer is dealing with this level of risk that's pretty robust.
Well, it's similar in the grocery store chain with fresh produce. The risk that Smithfield is absorbing or any other processor is that, okay, I bought the animal. I put the cost and energy into processing and freezing. Now I've got that product in a freezer. I'm paying money to run that freezer to buy the electricity. And so that's a substantial part of, you know, the food chain as far as cost. But again, the cost back to the it takes that part of the risk away from the family farm. But where it comes back to the farm, as I said earlier, is just if those farmers aren't getting as many animals through their barns in an annual year, it's just less income.
The volatility is still there.
Yeah.
Even if some of that risk is taken by the contract.
Yeah. Does it make sense from a business point of view to be a hog farmer and take on that kind of risk and still have a larger company owning your product?
Well, that's, in my view, that's the way our food industry has evolved over the last 50 or 60 years. The economies of scale, most of these commodity crops, whether it's pork, poultry, corn, soybeans, we grow them in large quantities. We basically feed the world in this country with our agriculture products. And so the profit margin back to the farm is so small, the only way you can really make a good living at it is to do volume. And yet I can't, as an individual family farmer, I can't afford to go out and buy all the processing equipment, to go buy all the stainless steel freezing equipment and you know, do that processing on a local home level. Because I can't move enough birds or hogs through that smaller system to stay competitive price-wise. And, you know, there's so many factors. Labor overseas is a factor. The processing facilities is a factor. You know, how efficient they are. It all ties together. And, you know, the farmers are basically buying a contract or signing a contract and saying, I'm going to do this piece of the puzzle. I'm going to do this small part of it and let somebody else deal with the, you know, with the processing and packing and shipping and marketing and all that work.
And there's folks locally and across the country too that are doing their part to relocalize that system. So you'll find names of some of our local farmers on restaurant menus these days. The farmers market that's started there at Tidal Creek, you can meet some of these farmers and talk to them face to face. You don't have to get all of your news from print and social and news media. Go talk to the farmer, really see what this is like, and give him a hug or her.
And on that note, got a very thoughtful email from listener Vivian. She raises a number of points about what it's like to be a farmer in North Carolina. But one of the things that she points out, she says, North Carolina farmers consider media bias to be the biggest challenge they face. Lack of appreciation, she writes, among public consumers is also a major obstacle. She says the ideology must change in consumer minds to be front and center in our grocery stores. Farming equals good. America has the lowest food costs of any country in the world. Professor Thomas Grennis of NC State, is that true, that the United States has the lowest food costs in the world?
Well, I think so. I think it's going to vary quite a bit by product. We're certainly not lowest for bananas, but the United States is the world's biggest agricultural exporter and has been for a long time, and has an agricultural trade surplus. So some people in Washington don't like these deficits, but the agricultural trade is a surplus. So the United States is a very successful agricultural, and so trade's important, and whether markets are closed up or not is quite important. By the way, on this issue of media bias, there may be some of that, but it's also true in these farm-to-table restaurants nowadays are becoming very, very fashionable. Farmers have become heroes. So that's another aspect of this image of farmers.
But are we talking about a different kind of farmer between, say, the contract farmers? And I'm not talking about vilifying those people at all. I'm just talking about the process, the farming process, and how it's produced. I mean, the small farmers that sell their stuff to farm-to-table restaurants, they own their land, usually. They own their product. They're selling it. It's all under their control, and it's on a smaller scale. The people who contract with Smithfield Food, for instance, that is a process owned and regulated by Smithfield Foods. The farmers don't even own the product. Is Professor Grennis, can you speak to the economic differences there?
Here I would mostly defer to my colleagues on the details of these contracts, because you can have all kinds of contracts, and I don't know much about the details. And so the contract can be, person A does one, person B does two. Okay, specifically, animals are often owned by the bigger party. What's crucial, I think, and what I don't understand in these cases of pollution is who owns the waste? Who is responsible for the waste? And that can be written in the contract in various ways. I don't know what the answer to that one is.
Mark? Who owns the waste?
I
mean, it's Smithfield that's getting sued.
Yes. I mean, the waste product... Again, I think there is some contractual issues there that I'm not familiar with. However, the waste is managed by the farms, by the families.
And highly regulated.
I mean, they have annual inspections. They have testing requirements on a monthly or quarterly basis, depending on what they're looking for. The nutrient load in the waste in a hog lagoon typically... If you were going to use that exclusively to fertilize a corn crop, we were talking in our office the other day, it would take about 10 to 12 inches of lagoon water to provide enough nitrogen to supply a corn crop on a weekly basis. We've had 10 to 12 inches of rain in the last 2 weeks, and we all know how wet it is around this area. If you have to do that to a corn crop every week to supply that much nutrient, you're just going to flood your crop out, and there's no value in it. So,
and that's a natural recirculation of nutrients that happens on the farm. All these are very natural processes. Somebody said the other day to me that there's two places to get a ham. One's the left cheek of the hog and one's the right cheek. And there's a whole lot of, we'll say, waste that comes out in between. So,
wow, that's a visual to carry with us for the rest of the day.
So these byproducts of pork production or poultry production, whether it's large scale or small scale, with the small scale poultry folks, it's there, and our farmers have to deal with it so that we have good, solid, safe food supply. And right, not to vilify the animal operations, and not to just build up any other type of agriculture. They're all farmers. And of the 50,000 farmers in North Carolina, by the way, that's a 15% drop over the 15 years of that statistics from 1997. Most of those farms are less than 50 acres. So it's tough to raise a family on a small farm. Mm-hmm. And so you have to look for higher value factors for your operation. And so animal agriculture is one of those. It's a higher value commodity rather than just grain. You're not going to make it for you and your family just by growing corn, wheat, and soybeans on a small acreage.
Why is there a drop in the number of farmers over the last 15 years in the state? Does that have anything to do with tobacco, or is it all kinds of factors?
It's tobacco, the loss of tobacco production. It's development pressure on the land.
Huge development pressure, especially,
especially in
our part
of the... Especially in Pender and Brunswick County. But there's just numerous factors. I mean, farmers are getting older as a general trend. They're looking to retire or sell the land to another neighbor or a family member if they're there to take it over.
And that's been a concern that I've had in this part of the state. So I've heard more and more farmers talk to me about, I don't know who's going to take my farm when I'm done. The average age of farmers in North Carolina is right at 59. And so this is not an easy industry to start up in.
It's
and it's not an easy industry to pass along either.
To get out of.
Yes, Professor Grennis.
This is a national trend. It's just not just North Carolina. Right. So the number of farmers in the United States continues to go down and down. Total production of agriculture in the United States continues to go up and up. So output per worker continues to rise. So it's new technology, great ideas from NC State, et cetera, new technology. Lots of improvements have made American farmers more productive than ever. And so that's something that's true for North Carolina, but also for the whole country.
And we have an email. George asks, when did the neighbors move next to the farms? I think he's referring to the nuisance lawsuits and the people, the neighbors who were complaining about the odor, the flies, and the trucks. Were they there before the farms or after? I've heard this question a lot. And he says, I think this makes a huge difference.
I don't know the specifics of, you know, the plaintiffs versus the farmers or Smithfield in these cases is, you know, who was there first. I think it's a combination of cases. You know, there's some people that have been there longer than some of these newer processing or production facilities.
Okay. So. And you can expand on that when we come back if you need to. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. The international trade war is affecting North Carolina farmers. We have three experts with us today, two directors from NC State's County Cooperative Extension offices and an NC State economics professor emeritus. And we're taking your questions. Call us on this Wednesday, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of North Carolina agriculture through the lens of the escalating international trade war, nuisance lawsuits targeting pork producers, and the extreme rainfall this summer. With us to answer your questions, Thomas Grennis, Professor Emeritus of Economics and Agricultural Resource Economics from NC State. He's joining us via Skype. Also here, Mark Seitz, Pender County Cooperative Extension Director for NC State, and Mark Blevins, Brunswick and New Hanover County Cooperative Extension Director. Ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. I want to go back to something that Vivian wrote. She writes, adversarial groups such as the Waterkeepers Alliance are quick to degrade and speak down about state-permitted swine farms, yet there's minimal dialogue from this group about municipal sewage spills. And this is something that I've heard come up before, how particularly in the news, some of these sewage spills, which are sometimes many thousands of gallons of waste, get a little blurb on the news. But then there's all this attention on the effect of these hog farms on nearby waterways. Mark Blevins.
So I don't like to pit one problem against another, but yeah, we're all part of this ecosystem. So the waste that each of us produce has to get fixed somewhere. And it's an even smaller scale situation. It's heavily regulated on those hog farms as well. And yeah, to eat, that has to happen. Not the waste into the rivers. Our farmers are so careful. I was talking to one this morning about the waste sample that he has to submit to the Department of Agriculture lab in Raleigh. Hey, when are my results going to be back so that I can make those decisions for my farm. It's a very scientific process. These farmers are very smart. They're very in tune with what's going on in their land and their neighbors. And it's sad to see some of those conflicts arise between neighbors.
Vivian also points out that it's rained, as one of you was saying before, in eastern North Carolina for approximately 15 days straight. Many hog producers are concerned about the amount of rain, the fact that we can't pump onto recycle spray fields until it dries out. Huge challenge to many in the swine industry. And she writes, heaven forbid one drop of swine affluent should hit the ground. We're all terrified we'll be thrown under the bus and buried under the jail if that should happen, or that we will be demonized by news media as careless environmental polluters.
Well,
may I say something about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Professor Grenis.
I'm sympathetic to the question. It is definitely true around the whole country that municipal sewage is a major source of pollution. And also military bases are a major source. So it's not just the private for-profit sector, it's the government sector that also is a major source. And more generally, I would say if you look around the world, it's not just the profit motive that brings about this kind of pollution. The former Soviet Union was one of the most polluted places in the world. So you get the wrong incentives, you're gonna get some wrong results.
We have a question. Ethan Crouch writes, if waste handling from CAFOs, and he's talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, which are these pork and poultry farm operations, he says, if this is a natural process and not a big deal, according to your guests, why did the courts rule against them and levy such huge fines? The courts don't make judgments like that without wrongdoing.
Well, I've been reading a lot. I mean, obviously, this is a big issue, and it's in the news a lot, and farmers all over the country are talking about it. Social media is full of concerns and questions. Ag economist that I follow that does a lot of public speaking on this topic made the statement the other day that, you know, agriculture is not, as an industry, it's not exempt from scrutiny. And we certainly, as an industry, are culpable for needing to find better ways to deal with some of these waste issues. I guess the argument that I've heard in these local court cases is that the farms that have been sued have been following all state regulations, you know, that they've been told you have to follow this guideline. None of them that I'm aware of have had any violations by state regulatory agencies. So, you know, it's kind of like you and me driving a car down the highway. If, you know, if I'm going 60 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour speed limit zone, technically I'm violating the law. Am I going to get a ticket? Probably not. There are issues, you know, there's certainly issues with putting this much waste in a concentrated system. But at the same time, we don't, our food chain is such that we can't feed everybody in this country, let alone others outside the country, with small animal or small production agriculture like it used to be 50 or 60 or 70 years ago. We can fill niches with that and do a very good job of it. But, you know, as I've said for a long time, I used to work in the vegetable canning industry, and you can't feed 17 million people in New York City with rooftop gardens.
But as you suggest, perhaps it's time for a paradigm shift. It is interesting because the argument against changing the hog lagoon system is that it'll cost too much. And I don't know if that cost is going to be a cost on Smithfield or on the hog producers, the farmers. But it is notable that the company has covered waste pits and otherwise tried to capture the smell and bacteria resulting from pooling liquefied waste in Missouri and Colorado.
Sure. We've talked about technology a couple of times, and those are some of the innovations in agriculture that make a big difference and allow high yields on crops and safer situations and fewer environmental impacts. Sometimes you can tarp the top of one of these lagoons and capture some of the gases off of that and run generators to produce electricity. It's really neat, the things that our farmers and our research institutions like NC State are coming up with to do. So
considering that Smithfield had a profit of $1 billion last year, does it make sense that maybe they get forced into a regulatory corner and need, you know, find a way to adopt new technology that wouldn't create nuisances for neighbors?
Well, I would say that's in some respects, in terms of agriculture in general, that's a double-edged sword, or double-edged argument, I guess, in that you have a lot of people that are thoroughly opposed to large animal production or large crop production farms like we've, you know, the economies of scale have forced us into. And yet, when these companies try to implement some of this new technology, it's, you know, it's either deemed as hasn't been tested sufficiently, you know, we shouldn't be implementing this particular system, or it's just, you know, I don't want to buy food from that system. Whatever, you know,
there's consumer or governmental backlash?
I would say it's consumer backlash more than governmental. There's some governmental backlash. I mean, I've seen it in my career on the industry side when I used to work in industry, where companies try to implement new things and it doesn't exactly match the regulatory language. And so the regulatory agencies kind of put their heels on the ground and say, wait a minute, let's slow down on this implementation. So it's a back and forth. It's a constantly changing issue. And there's no quick, simple fix. And it, you know, ultimately it comes down to who's going to pay the bill to implement some of this stuff.
It's going to be more expensive food that will be the result of any major changes like that. So we have to be willing to pay more money for food if we want to see that system to be changed.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the outlook for North Carolina farmers in light of the trade war, the rain, the recent nuisance lawsuits targeting pork producers. With us today, Mark Blevins, director for the Brunswick and New Hanover County Cooperative Extension for NC State, Mark Sykes, director for the Pender County Cooperative, and Thomas Grennis, professor emeritus of economics at NC State. You have just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in by calling us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Susan from Brunswick County, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Did you have a comment?
Yes, my comment is I worked extensively with the trading contracts that you mentioned you hadn't seen, and I worked as someone who was building a trading system, and they gave me a stack of these contracts to read so that we could accurately build the system and model them.
You're talking about contracts between
the farmer who's growing, let's say, the pork or the soybeans, who's selling the pork and the soybeans directly to one of these big agricultural conglomerates,
okay,
who then buy those products from them and process them and, you know, freeze them and sell them to, you know, the grocery stores, et cetera. So what happens modeling the risk, the farmer will sign what's called an optionality grower accounting contract with a big company saying, I agree to, and the big companies write these contracts. The big company decides how much they need. And they model, like you said, either a year or 2 years out. It depends on the product. So let's say it's for, I don't know, I've looked at the ones for cattle, not for hogs, but it's similar. So they might say, a year out, I will buy it, the quantity of between, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 cattle from you, depending on how many you want to give me, and the quality needs between X and Y range, and the delivery dates need to be between, you know, B and C. So the farmer raises how many cattle he thinks he needs to, maybe his target is to deliver 1,500. He owns all the risk on those cattle. So maybe he decides, I know I'm going to have about 500 that I lose to disease and whatnot. And then he shows up and delivers his cattle from, you know, a semi, et cetera, at literally the processing plant door. Now, if he has 500 cattle that die, he owns those cattle until he delivers them at the door. Mm-hmm. He owns all that risk. So he pays for those 500 cattle that die. I just wanted to clarify that the big companies, the processing, you know, companies, like, I won't say any names because I want to get anyone, I won't want to go down that road. they don't own those baby calves or those baby hogs the whole way through the process. Just to clarify, the farmer owns all that risk. That's the thing one, until they drop them off. And then thing number two, how these trade wars impact it. You're feeding those hogs and cattle. So if the price of soybeans skyrocketed, I've already signed a fixed price contract with a big company and agreed to sell my hog for whatever dollars. Let's make it easier and say, you know, whatever, $5 a pound. So I'm going to sell it at $5 a pound, and I'm estimating that I'm going to pay, you know, 50 cents, let's say a bushel, for the soybeans that I feed my pig. And I know that I can make enough money doing that if I'm going to get $5 a pound. Well, if the price of those soybeans skyrocket because of a trade war, I'm going to lose all my money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the trade war impacts a farmer. Now, there's a very complicated trading strategy that a farmer could implement, which is called hedging. Complicated. Some farmers know how to do this. It could prevent them from losing that money on what they're feeding their hogs. These big processing plants, you know, these big ag companies, they hire an entire team of traders. This is what I worked on, to implement those hedging trading strategies. They spend millions of dollars implementing. Now, granted, they have a much larger operation. It's a big-time deal to implement those trading strategies to hedge that loss. Most of your small family farmers are not going to do that. That's where the trade war is going to hit them.
Yes.
And so, Susan, if you had to characterize the deal then for one of these farmers, how would you characterize it? I mean, does it make sense for the farmer? Is he taking on too much risk for the reward?
I would say that they bear the majority of the risk in the deal and that the big companies cover themselves because they have hedging. They have a specialized team of highly trained people who know how to hedge their risk, and the farmers do not. And also, the farmers are bearing already the risk of, well, the trade war, if you want to abstract it out, the new thing with the trade war is the fluctuating prices of the feed. The farmer's already bearing the risk of animals dying. That hasn't changed. So let's subtract that out. That's already there for the farmer. And I grew up on a farm. I grew up on an operation that had turkeys and soybeans and corn. And we lived under the constant fear of getting a sickness. Because if we have one year where a bunch of our animals die, we're out of business. That's what the small family farmer lives under, that constant fear. And if those prices fluctuate too greatly, again, you're out of business. You're gone. It takes one bad year.
Right. Susan, really appreciate you taking the time to weigh in. Thank you so much for giving us that perspective on the contract. We have just a minute or so left. How is weather impacting farmers this year? We heard about pork farmers and how it's been difficult to dispose of the hog waste by spraying because there are rules about that with rain. But what about other kinds of farmers?
July was the fourth wettest in Wilmington's history. And so, yeah, that kept our temperatures down, but that's not easy for grain to dry. So our corn is going to stay in the field longer, and it's tough to go and pick things when the soil's wet. The farmer knows that you're going to destroy your soil structure if you go out there on a wet field. So it's not going to be easy this season to get our stuff harvested.
Blueberries took a beating just because they suck up so much water when we get that kind of rain. It makes them soft and makes them hard to harvest and shelf life.
Big thanks to Chad, Vivian, Ethan, and Susan for your comments.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Thanks, Mark Blevins, Mark Seitz, Professor Grenis. Thank you all so much for being with us today. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster and acting producer today. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. You can also tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.